What muscles I have are aching. My assets are sluggish and slow. The only deposits I've been making are at a bank with the first name Snow. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. Today we have a bit of music. Vicki Emerson, West Wisconsin's own, with a new album that we'll sample, and we'll get her interpretation of it and the creative process that the concept originated in. And Wee Banjo 3 brings their Celtic bluegrass hybrid energy from Nashville to a show next week in Eau Claire. We will enjoy getting to know lead singer and guitarist David Howley. Jim Oliver welcomes Jennifer Chapman, UW Eau Claire Theater Director, for The House of Blue Leaves, opening next week. And Jim also features a compendium of other stage productions in production around West Wisconsin. But first, we're going to let the show go to the birds. Steve Bechkel is well known and a revered naturalist in our region and state, one who others look to for insight and wisdom, because he's willing to walk the walk, not just write the right, as in books about the natural and avian world. It's not something he does for authenticity. It's who he was before the thought of sharing it came along. And now, what he does is in the title of his sixth and his latest book, Walk the Walk, Camp the Camp, Bird the Bird. There's more to the title, and it'll be revealed in the conversation we recorded just a couple days ago. Must a person rough it to get the full natural Monty?
Well, camping is not, I don't think, a natural thing to people. It's not easy.
Right,
I think it.
Right.
When I have a joke when I do a program. I show PowerPoint now, and I'll show, this is my wife's idea of camping, and I'll show the African safari with the tent and the platform and the made bed and the table with the food on it.
Okay.
And I'll show, this is my idea of camping. It'll be a sleeping bag on some rocks.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so I think that most people believe that getting out of doors is kind of scary. You do have to sacrifice something in the way of comfort to get the comfort of being in nature. You get in a sleeping bag, the cold air drafts in, there are scary night sounds, you know, it rains and the tent is wet. You got to go through a lot of work just to get out there. And it says something about the human situation, too, that we are really so far removed that it's a chore for us to get outside and get out camping. And you think of camping as getting away from it all. And
yeah,
it's kind of ridiculous. You just go in your car and you take stuff out of the back of your car, you set up a tent and, wow, look at me, I'm in the wild of nature.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
To really go into wilderness in the U.S. is of course, unheard of. People just don't do that. There's so little wilderness that we think of, you know, a park, a state park, as, wow, we're getting out away from it all.
And travel trailers are called campers.
Yes, campers.
So there's a difference between camping and doing what you do.
My dad passed away on February 10th. He never camped away a day in his life. And so where did I get that from? How did I learn to enjoy camping?
I was going
to
ask, where did the Birdman of Eau Claire, was it handed to him, or was he just established?
We took family trips, and I got, my dad would take us and pile us into the country squire, and we'd go to New York, or we'd go to Louisiana, or we'd go to Florida.
We had a country squire. Yeah,
yeah, everybody did.
It was a three-seater.
Yes, and did they have the little pop-up seats in the back that
yes.
face each other?
Mm-hmm.
And we could sleep. Those were the good old days. We didn't have to belt in. You could sleep four kids
oh, yeah.
in the back and just wake up, and you were almost there.
We had,
you know,
five kids and two parents.
That's right.
Your writing, and you've done a lot of it, is a legacy for your sons, or if others enjoy it, then that's icing on the cake. Could it be as pedestrian as that?
Writers write because they have something to say, and it must be said. And so I have to say these things because I believe very strongly in them, and I have this creative urge, and I love the challenge of writing. But yeah, the book is about us. It's about mm-hmm. me and my sons and my wife, and I want them, in the years that they have on earth, to think of all the things we did together and to cherish those things and to maybe increase those things and do them themselves and think of new ways to do it. And it's a family record. What do we have? You know, I paint, and so I'll leave behind a couple paintings, but my words will survive me, I hope, and my ideas and my ethics and my love for wilderness and wild things, but
yeah.
That's it.
You have a line in your dedication that reads, "We are the species who swings wildly between the potentiality for astonishing love and creativity and the greatest capacity for cruelty and selfishness." Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, yeah. And name me another species on Earth that could fit that description.
We seem to get better at the latter more as time goes on.
I guess it has something to do with how we teach our kids. But you're right. Maybe with the greater, the increase in overpopulation, maybe there are more mean, cruel, greedy people. I'm going to say, humans are my favorite people on the planet. They're great. I love them.
Good.
But when you're talking about, and I'm a witness to things like that, greed, apathy, injustice, bigotry, all those things, I'm feeling like Jesus in the temple. I don't have any patience for that kind of cruelty. And if you're about exploitation of natural resources or destroying beautiful natural systems, then I'm not your friend and your ally. I'm your foe.
I read an article over the weekend that said we can expect the repercussions of climate change will lead to more and more of our worst traits. Mm-hmm. It'll be more uncomfortable. It'll be more inconvenient. Many things will be changing, and a lot of people can't handle change. It could be this tsunami of natural things that make humans react differently.
Well, climate change is the result of our bad behaviors. It is the result of our faults and flaws. And the question is, can the better side of us win out? Can we do something about it? One of the things I'm frustrated about is that Congress, U.S. Congress, hasn't done one thing.
Yeah.
It hasn't passed any legislation about climate
change.
Well,
we're going backwards now.
Well, under this administration, yes. But I still believe, I don't know, I'm an impossible optimist. For all I see, I still believe that humans are smart enough, good enough, wise enough, brilliant enough to figure this out. And I don't mean going to Mars.
We have things to do here before we do that.
Putting the brakes
on. It's like me
on.
Going to Europe. I could go to Europe, but I have too much of America to see you. I
haven't been to Europe.
Steve Bechkel with us. Walk the walk, camp the camp, bird the bird. If I read the rest of the title, we wouldn't have time to do the rest of the interview. The quest for meeting every species of bird on planet Earth. He also wanted, don't I use this in the past tense, spend a year outside my comfortable little house? You've done that, right?
Oh, yeah. I've surpassed the 365-day thing.
But now you want to do it in a different way, right?
Void the tent. I like
That's
sleeping
right.
without the tent. And
okay.
So to me, I want to be under the sky where I can just lay on my back and look at the stars. And that's the ideal way to go.
Now, the last few words of the subtitle of your new book, Follow the Trail to Its Logical Conclusion. There's the question that has to pop up. Is there a logical conclusion?
We
Have
all
you
know
determined what it is?
We all know what that is.
It's Earth, the big one?
Earth is my final resting place. You know, one day I'll bed down with her and I won't get up. That's the way it works. But I'll tell you something.
Okay.
When that happens, the ground won't be as hard and I'll sleep better than I ever did.
And more soundly.
Yes.
People who don't seem to care about or even see and acknowledge animals have as much right, maybe more than we, for as long and as healthy and as happy a life as is possible. But how can people not see that? That has to be another frustration on your part, because you study birds.
Oh, yeah. I think birds are beautiful, essential. I think they add to the quality of life. And, naturally, I think that why doesn't everybody else think that way? But we know as scientists two things. One we know is that each organism believes that they are most important organism on the planet. That's a biological initiative. It's what we do. It's,
really?
Look out for number one. We look after ourselves first, and the ultimate goal is to survive, not to worry about birds. And we also know that scientifically, half the population is born with some genetic compensity to like animals. And those people that like animals are usually more empathetic. They're more compassionate. And there's another half of our population that, again, scientifically proven, is not as empathetic. Don't like dogs, don't like cats, don't like birds, whatever. It's not a natural thing, again, for everybody to like that. I know a couple people who have avophobia, in fact, that are scared of birds. But if you are exposed to things, to birds, if you see them, if you experience them, if you hear them, if you're in the wild with them, you are naturally overcome. You become attached. You all of a sudden become a conservationist because the bird that you know is not invisible to you, and you will work to protect that bird, and you will conserve that resource.
Now, I got the book late. I did the Al's Notes version, skimming for topics, etc. I am really, though, looking forward to reading all the other pages. This now is your sixth
Thank
book.
You.
Give us remind us of some of the other books that you have on the market.
The first book I did was the All of This and Robins Too, which is the guide to where to find birds in Wisconsin. Okay. I did Cat Tales, a read to kids book. For Vision and the Word, I did The Giant Who Knew All About Everything, which was a children's book. Did I cover them all? Oh, Make Birds Not War was the other one, essays. This was a shorter, lighter version of Walk the Walk. I think Walk the Walk is actually heftier, meatier, and some better articles. Although a couple of the articles in Make Birds Not War were actually published in magazines. The one on Black Swifts was one of my favorites. I really thought that was a good article, I was very proud of that one.
Does nature contribute to your positivity, to your optimism?
Absolutely.
Would you be a different kind of person? Would you be more cynical if you did not and continue to spend more time out among
You know, there are things in life that inject energy and inject positivity that make you better, that make you stronger, that make you feel good. If the sun is shining, I like that better than when it's raining. I'm a fair weather guy. But birds do that for me, and birds song. And I just have grown up enjoying green trees and watching the clouds. And I like tiger beetles and wildflowers. I like rocks. I like pine cones, all those things. I think part of it is that I love beauty. I'm very sensitive to systemic interactions. I see systems, and as an ecologist and a biologist, I just happen to feel those very strongly in the water cycle, how things change, how things move, how things interact. And that just rang with me in the 70s when we got Earth Day. I just thought, wow, they are speaking my language here when they start talking about interactions and ecotones and ecology.
Are you optimistic that we're going to do it in the end? We're not going to screw it all up ultimately?
Well, I have a friend who is a world-renowned scientist, one of the most renowned ecologists in the world. And his line is, well, you know, whatever people do, the world will survive. And there will always be a planet, and birds will bounce back, and trees will bounce back. You have to believe good will win out. Otherwise, what's the point?
But believing should be an action verb.
That's what getting out is about. That's what being outside is about. The optimism is that, you know, we still have those forests and we still have those birds. And as long as they're there, I'm loving it and living it. And so right now, all I can do is talk about it. I can share pictures of birds, stories about birds. And I can say, you know, look at how beautiful they are. And I believe in that power, that if I do that, people will be converted to that kind of love. I think that is the task of any good citizen. I think it's the greatest act of patriotism, in fact, environmentalism and conservation, is to say, I love this so much, and here's why. Let's protect it. Let's preserve it.
Steve Bechkel, thanks for coming in. Good book. Great book.
Thank you, Al.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. Down the road, We Banjo 3, The Music, A Member, and The Message. They're touring Wisconsin cities, including Eau Claire. Yeah. Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory with Feb Hugh Airy, featuring painters Deborah Stahl Kinsley, Roxanne Deer, and Deb Mortal, with work from textile artist Barb Erickson, artzgallery.org. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Cellist Mark Kosower joins the symphony for its Marching Through March concert Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Pablo Center at the Confluence. Tickets at pablocenter.org. Vicki Emerson, who grew up near Elmwood, Wisconsin, and then set off to trek the big, wide, wonderful world of musicianship, is back to being a Midwesterner. I first talked with Vicki during my first year in the Spectrum West cockpit 10 years ago, 2009, and she's going strong, and yet another album of mostly originals is now out. She's playing around here soon, so we rang her up and asked about a little bit of everything. I listened to this album with a fine, couldn't be fine-tooth comb, a fine-tuned ear.
That sounds good.
So here's my take on it. This work has the familiar Vicki voice, but there's an obscurity to it. It's a wonderful one. These songs, to me, feel like they have messages attached, whether they're subliminal, whether they're hidden between the lines, or blatant. First, tell me about the title Steady Heart, and if that's defining anything or anyone in particular. And next, if this album was designed from the beginning to represent something or the state of someone.
Those are good questions, Al.
Well, thank you.
At the end of the day, they're all love songs of some sort, if it's to another person or if it's even to myself. Songs of strength, like the reckoning, to A Steady Heart, which is a song I wrote for my husband. Love, as you've been married a while, you go from that euphoric love when you first fall in love, and then it becomes something more enduring, and that it can be tested over and over again. So, you know, love is complicated, and then there's songs about family and friends that are battling mental illness. Mm-hmm. So I'm really proud of this record, but at the end of the day, if you want to simplify it, I do think they're all love songs, and hence the name Steady Heart, because it takes a steadiness and patience to really work through some of the larger things that we deal with as adults in our life.
All right. I have more observation now.
Oh.
And now it makes sense, because
Okay. Here's
my next paragraph. The reason I had these feelings is that many of the songs felt to me like a softly howling wolf, or on human terms, as if it's someone standing somewhere secluded, calling out to anyone within earshot. If someone hears, fine. But if not, that's cool too, because I just wanted to say some things and get some things off my chest.
Yeah. There is some element of that, and that's why, you know, I produced this album. I've in the past worked with Matt Patrick, and I've had a great experience with that, but I really kind of wanted to work with a female producer this time around, and after doing some searching, I realized there aren't very many of them. I still find that very odd, but I decided to do it myself, and I worked with a really great band. I wanted to hear what an album would sound like just from my point of view, so this is the end result.
You know, people tell stories in different ways musically. There's a lot of minor chords in these songs. A minor chord doesn't have to be something that makes you feel bad. Minor chords sometimes, in fact, many times, emit more emotion. And I'll be honest, the whole album feels to me like I'm riding on a train. I was going to say it feels like a train ride, but then I thought the moment you heard the word train, you'd think I was going to say train wreck. But I wouldn't say that about your album. In fact, I determined that you could have put a distant train whistle on this album, and it would have fit perfectly, although you did, in a way, with the female backups on The Reckoning. That's very train whistle-y sound.
It is, for sure. That song in particular is sort of being picked apart and kind of watched under a new light because we put a music video out for it last week.
I saw that.
Yeah, and it's really resonating with people, mostly for the good, some for the bad, but that's okay. I don't write music for everybody to love it. It'll find its way to the people who do love it.
The Reckoning has a message. It is for your sisters.
Well, it's for the sisterhood. I think it's like women supporting other women.
Right.
Yeah, so I actually wrote the song with a friend of mine named Graham Bramblett. We wrote it in sort of, I would say, an ambiguous way because we weren't quite sure what was going to be used for or even if it would make it on the album. But then when we started playing it out live, people really responded to it, and I thought, oh, I think I know exactly what this is about now. So we had friends do choreography. My friend Genevieve did all the painting, and then there are several friends, Sarah Morris, Jillian Ray, and Annie Fitzgerald. They signed on to do it as well. And the result is depicting women, supporting other women.
It's viewable on YouTube now?
Yeah. So if you just Google Vicki Emerson, The Reckoning, it'll come right up.
Okay. She just said her name, so I may not have to say it. Vicki Emerson on the phone with us. The new album is Steady Heart, and she is appearing March 9th at one of my favorite venues, the Big River Theater in beautiful Alma, Wisconsin. A lot of this album has a bunch of originals, but you also have some fun arranging. For instance, Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. That's a unique arrangement. And then you finish with a nice little waltz, the Boat Song, to which one can dance off the stage.
Yeah, Crystal Gayle, I loved her growing up, and I particularly loved that song. It was my favorite song when I was a little kid. And when we started putting the album together, I did want to put a cover on there. I'd never done that before. And I thought about what's a song that means something to me. Because I think that's always a good place to start instead of, oh, what would sound cool? I think it has to resonate with you emotionally. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And I printed out the lyrics, and I thought, well, you know, the lyrics, you know, her version is very light, kind of a little jazzy. And what if you read it as, you know, I didn't mean to treat you bad, you know, but the underlying text is kind of like, but I did. Mm-hmm. I totally did. You know, I treated you bad, and I kind of don't care, really, too much. And you know, I also was like, you feel bad, I feel bad, but it's sort of like, so what? It happened. And when we talked about it with the band, that we were like, I think we should just put some so what in here, some real attitude and sass. And then I worked up that bass line that opens it up. I worked that up on my guitar, and then I played it for the band, and then we just ran with it. So that was, it's a really fun one. They play it so amazing live. It's really fun to play. But even solo, I play all the bass part when I do it myself. So that's kind of fun, too.
Yeah, cool.
And then, yes, the boat song. Every time I sing that song, I'm transported back to the studio because that was the last song that we did together. And we all sang around one big mic. We just did a take of it. It was a lovely moment.
I like that, too, when somebody has run out of song titles and they go, what the hell are we going to call this? Let's just call it the boat song.
The boat song. You know, there was never any other working title. When I wrote it, it was just like, this is what it is.
Yeah. So how does this album feel to you? I mean, you've done a few now. Where does this fit?
I really love it. My band and I have been playing some band shows lately, and we all kind of recognize the songs are fun to play. I mean, it's been very well received from press and radio. That leads me to believe that we did a good job.
Okay.
So I really love it. But I do feel like this is the best and cohesive songwriting that I've done.
Good. Well, who's going to occupy the Big River Theater stage on the 9th of March?
That is just going to be me.
Well, that's cool.
That'll be me and a guitar and my keyboard.
The stage doesn't have room for too many other people anyway, which is okay.
That's what I heard.
The album is Steady Heart, Vicki Emerson. Thanks for being with us on WPR. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
I've been dreaming, I've been scheming, how do I keep you all to myself? I'm tired of the fast pace, I've given up.
The music continues as some excellent musicians, We Banjo 3, travel to Wisconsin, beginning a tour on Saturday. That's coming up. Stages and seasons at West Wisconsin theater companies are warming up. Now, if only our weather would learn how to do that. Here's Jim Oliver.
The Phipps Children's Theater will present Willy Wonka through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Boxcar Children will be staged through Sunday by the Spring Valley Stagehands Theater. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will stage The Cat in the Hat Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Oxford Theater. The Menominee Theater Guild will stage How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The show will continue the following Friday through Sunday. There will be evening performances each Friday and Saturday with matinees on Saturday and Sunday, both weekends. A dinner theater production of Tony and Tina's Wedding will be staged Friday and Saturday and March 8th and 9th by the Northern Star Theater in the Rice Lake Elsk Lodge. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater will present Honky Tonk Laundry Fridays and Saturdays beginning March 8th and continuing through May 18th. University Theater at the University of Wisconsin River Falls will perform Argonautica March 7th through the 9th and the 14th through the 16th in the Blanche Davis Theater in the Kleinpell Fine Arts Building at the University. Caught in the Net will be performed by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild March 7th through the 10th and the 15th through the 18th in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. And the Neillsville Players will stage a dinner theater production of The Sound of Murder March 15th through the 17th and the 22nd through the 24th at the Clark Cultural Arts Center in Neillsville.
Thank you, sir. This is Spectrum West on WPR. The Oliver series continues as Jim and guest explore the details surrounding a university production getting set to open, providing a respite from wintry activities of the arduous kind.
The House of Blue Leaves is a play by American playwright John Gare. It premiered off-Broadway in 1971 and was revived in 1986 off-Broadway and on-Broadway, revived again on-Broadway in 2011. The theater department at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire will open its production of The House of Blue Leaves Thursday, March the 7th in the Pablo Center in downtown Eau Claire. In the studio to talk about The House of Blue Leaves is the director, Dr. Jennifer Chapman, associate professor of theater. A review said that John Gare doesn't make things easy on the people who produce his work. His characters are bundles of neurotic contradictions, his plots spin giddily out of control, and his dense language is full of images that appear and disappear like mysterious little dreams. So it sounds like you've issued a challenge to your students and perhaps yourself.
Definitely. The characters in this play, just like people in real life, are very complicated. They are people who have reached middle age. Their hopes and dreams for what their lives would become did not come true. And they live in a state of fantasy that it is still possible, and yet they really don't do the right things to achieve them. And so the play is both one of the funniest plays I know, but also one of the most tragic that I know as well.
The last time you were here, which is a little over 2 years ago, you were directing The Nerd at the university.
Yeah.
That was a farce. Now, this is called a black comedy. So will you describe the difference for us?
They have a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. Typically, a farce has a lot of physical comedy. Mistaken identity typically has lots of doors that people are running in and out of. Mm-hmm. Physically very demanding for actors. A black comedy or dark comedy is usually a play that is both funny and sad at the same time. The moments in life you can both laugh at and cry about equally. Dark comedy also often has some absurd situations in it or actions or language to make a point, but that might not be realistic.
Why don't you tell us what the play is about? There's something about the Pope came to town, among other things.
John Gore wrote this play in response to an experience he had in childhood. He grew up in Brooklyn, and in 1965, he traveled with his grandmother to Rome to go and see the Pope. And on the day they arrived in Rome, the Pope was actually in Brooklyn. And it always tickled him, this irony, and he structured the whole play around this event. The play is about a man named Artie Shaughnessy, a songwriter, but a failed songwriter. His day job, he works at the local zoo. He lives in a very old, rundown apartment with his wife, Bananas. Bananas suffers from a variety of mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, and some sort of undefined problems. Artie also has a girlfriend, and his girlfriend's name is Bunny. Bunny is his champion, and she wants him to succeed as a songwriter, and she believes they're going to go to California, and they're going to send Bananas, they call it, off to the loony bin. So because of this threesome, there's a lot of absurd, funny dialogue and situations. Artie and Bananas have an 18-year-old son named Ronnie, and he is AWOL from the Army. And he now has a plan. He wants to become famous. His father had always dreamed that Ronnie would become the Pope. And Ronnie has decided he's going to become famous in another way. Instead, he's going to blow up the Pope. And so he is constructing a bomb, but he's not real bright. And he makes some mistakes, and then he gets arrested by the end, and he blows up somebody else by accident. So you can see it's funny, but it's also deeply disturbing at times as well.
Yeah. It looks like a fairly large cast.
Yeah, for us, I would call it a mid-sized cast. Mm. It has some minor characters in it. One of the things I love about this play is that even the smallest role is so important because one of our smallest roles in the play delivers one of the best jokes. And so we've got some lower level characters that come in and really turn the world topsy-turvy.
Uh-huh. Talk a little bit about the setting. Is this just a one set show?
We are in an apartment in Brooklyn in 1965. Mm-hmm. Our set design is by Curtis Phillips. He works professionally all over the country, and he teaches set design at Minnesota Duluth. And our actors have had to learn a Brooklyn accent, so they've been studying that since late November. Our characters all come in and out of this one apartment. Three of our characters are three nuns in town to see the Pope. in full habits running around this apartment as well.
Oh, boy. Well, we're talking to Jennifer Chapman, who is director of the University of Wisconsin theater production of The House of Blue Leaves. I'm not exactly sure how to point this out, except that you're very involved in student, younger student theater.
Yeah.
I was wondering, do you make any selection decisions on the background from, let's say, high school for your university mm-hmm. actors who come?
Yeah, so when we choose plays at the university, we have a lot of different things we're considering. We want to think about the people who are in our program mm-hmm. and how they will best succeed. We want to think about what they need to learn. So, for example, we chose House of Blue Leaves because the language is very challenging. They have to learn an accent. The language is really, really dense. There is lots of physical work. The pace is really fast. And that is in contrast to some other shows that we're doing. We wanted to do a contemporary play. And even though this was written a while ago, it's not Shakespeare. It's contemporary. Mm-hmm. But we also think about our local community. What do we want to bring to our local community? How do we want to expand the offerings of theater in the Eau Claire area? A play that's been very successful for many years. And I think for good reason. It still really resonates today. Mm-hmm. So we take a lot of things into consideration.
So I recall you work with high school teachers.
I do.
For theater. Personal experience. I grew up in a small rural school, mm-hmm. and we used to have a Christmas program every year in mm-hmm. which we would, we would be in little one-act plays. And then I went on to high school and was in one-act, two-act, sometimes three-acts. Yeah, I remember one of my elementary school plays was something called Candy Goes on a Diet. Finally, when I was a senior in high school, we did a show called Our Hearts Were Young and Gay by Cornelia Otis Skinner, whom I haven't heard of since. In my high school experience, one of my plays was The Groom Said No, mm-hmm. Sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And how do you encourage, I guess, is that the word, theatrical advisors to do something more meaningful rather than these fluff pieces?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It is a difficult tightrope teachers walk in mm-hmm. public schools in many areas of the curriculum, not just in theater. How do we effectively and expansively educate young people while still meeting the needs of our community, while also challenging our community to be forward thinking about who our young people will be in the future? That's a lot to think about. Also, how do you meet people where they're at in different communities with the subject matter that you put on stage? I always encourage my student teachers to make relationships with community members, to build those relationships, and to understand what they expect out of their young people in the arts, and then to gently challenge communities by allowing students to speak their own truth on stage. And that can be in a variety of ways. You can still do fluffy plays, but by giving students opportunities to be on stage when they might not otherwise. Just that can be a real powerful act.
According to your biography at the university, so I'm sure this is absolutely accurate, you conduct research about high school theater across the United States.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What do you do?
Okay. Years ago, when I wrote my dissertation for my PhD, I had an opportunity to conduct interviews with teachers across the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in the plays that they commonly did. And we have documentation of popular plays for high school theater through an organization called the Educational Theater Association. So they collect that information. And what I saw was that since about 1938, the most popular plays on the high school stage have been Our Town and You Can't Take It With You, up until the present. Those are great plays. I love those plays. But in 2019, we have a lot of other plays, right? And so I was wondering, why do we see these plays over and over? So I talked to teachers about that. A lot of teachers talk to me about, cast size, needing a variety of kind of roles and needing a simple, easy set. And those plays definitely give us those things. But a number of teachers also talk to me about how their students often treated drama club or theater class or whatever it was at their school as sort of an unofficial, teachers called it this, unofficial gay straight alliance for their school. They talked a lot about how it was very difficult to produce plays that allowed students to speak their truth, plays that did not have any gay characters in them. I think that's still a challenge today. How do we support non-heterosexual youth in general with our theater work? I don't think we have good answers for that yet, but we do have a lot of exciting work happening across the country.
That sounds great. We've been talking to Dr. Jennifer Chapman, director of the University of Wisconsin Theater production of The House of Blue Leaves. The play opens Thursday, March the 7th, and continues through Saturday, March 9th, and March 13th to the 17th in the Pablo Center in downtown Eau Claire. Dr. Chapman, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, as usual, Mr. Oliver. David Howley of We Banjo 3 joins the program next. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota with the all-wheel drive RAV4, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or MarquardtToyota.com. You know, a byproduct of hosting this program is the opportunity to meet people who become favorites in their genre. I've established friendships with vans full of musicians. This week, happened again.
'Cause you left your home and everything you own just to follow the stars in the sky. You left those green, green hills.
I enjoy bluegrass and Celtic music if they're served as an hors d'oeuvre. A buffet is too filling for me. But We Banjo 3 wonderfully combines the two specialties. Two pairs of brothers from Ireland, now living in Nashville, brought their music across the water and found joy rolling in American bluegrass. A joy expressed in wildly entertaining live performances. Their Roots to Rise tour continues in six Wisconsin cities, including Eau Claire. David Holly is lead singer. We linked up with his home studio.
Dreams they caved in.
The Light in the Sky video, that had to have been the perfect situation. I don't think you had the fog trucked in.
No, that's all real.
Sunsets or sunrises, whenever you shot it, they happened very quickly, and you had a beautiful one in the background, and you had some wonderful drone shots. Did you shoot that all in one evening?
We shot it all in actually one morning. We had decided that we wanted to do this music video, and the initial crew that we had booked for it canceled on us. So in 3 days, I called a friend of mine and I said, man, I need you to rally the troops. And we just made it happen. We arrived on this overlook along the Cumberland River. We arrived at 3 a.m. in the morning, and we... with head torches on, we carried all our instruments and gear and everything up basically this cliff. It was pretty spectacular. I mean, sunrises all count on cloud cover, and it was really magical. As the sun came up, we just got more and more beautiful, and by 8 a.m. we were done and having breakfast. Yeah, I think that that video in particular, it speaks a lot to us as well, because we all come from Ireland. We grew up in the countryside in South Galway. And we spent an awful lot of time in the wilderness and up in the mountains. And, you know, I think it was pretty special to come to Tennessee, and particularly, I suppose, given all the heritage with the Scots-Irish and all the Irish people who moved into those hills. You can see why, because it really felt like home. And I suppose the song Light in the Sky has an air of kind of an immigration theme in it. I don't know, it was just a special moment. Everything kind of came together in the 11th hour.
As I mentioned, videos, I hope our audience goes online and finds them, put it on full screen and have a good time. You know, another video that I want to bring up is your happiness video. That had to be a heck of a lot of fun to shoot. And it looks like you're in an Irish town.
Yeah, we had this idea for happiness. We wanted to record it in our hometown of Galway. So again, yeah, we just put out a call to all our friends and said, hey, we're going to play some music on the street. Come on down. And thousands of people showed up. It was incredible. If your listeners watch the video, there's so many parts of Galway encapsulated in that. Young kids dancing, there's music. And then there's all these strange puppets, and that's Machnus. They're a visual performance group, and they fly all over the world. They make these amazing street contraptions and suits, and we just call them, and they're big fans of the band, and they brought out all their Machnus gear. And again, we shot that with two of our friends in Galway. We probably planned the video for about a week and went out and shot it. And I think we were, I think Happiness we shot in, I think it was 90 minutes is what exactly how long. That's one of the things about us is we're two sets of brothers. So we've been working together for all of our lives. Our sound engineer is convinced that we work best on sheer panic and chaos.
In the Happiness video, did I see a banjolin?
There is a banjolin in the Happiness video. Not allowed to openly carry a banjolin in public anymore.
No, I love those. We should explain to people who may not know, a banjolin is a smaller version of a banjo, and it has 8 strings like a mandolin.
Yeah, it's like a banjo and a mandolin elope together, and this is their child.
Kind of cute in a strange way.
Yeah, yeah.
I have been to them, and I've told others that I love bluegrass music, and I understand that bluegrass is only half of your reputation. You do a lot of great Celtic stuff, too. But when I attend bluegrass festivals, I find myself not being able to stay very long because all the music seems to run together to me. But you guys are a group that every festival should include because you kind of add a different dimension. You have an obvious love of what you're doing. Flat picking a banjo. I gotta say, I was happy to see that I wasn't the Lone Ranger in never having seen the banjo played with a flat pick. Another reason I find you guys refreshing, I read a quote in an interview you did with Milwaukee Magazine, "We are not what you think we are." And I think that's true.
It's strange. I suppose we all grew up in Ireland. We all play Irish music. That's our base language. But we all came to America at different stages and learned bluegrass and learned old time and folk music. And me and Martin's dad was a massive fan of American folk music. We had Johnny Cash and Earl Scruggs, even Garth Brooks blasting in our house at all times when we were kids. And so that's what we try and do with our music, is just we try and find that connection between Irish music and bluegrass. There's this incredible energy in Irish music. People describe it as you don't realize that you're standing up and dancing until after you've stood up and started dancing. And that's one of the things we like to play on. And you bring that kind of energy and drive and mix it with the kind of pyrotechnics of bluegrass. And I suppose that's what we try and do, is give it a new twist, a new stamp, and kind of make the music accessible as well for people, because I think that there's a lot of nuance in bluegrass and in Irish music that can sometimes go over the head of the listener. And what we try and do is just bring it back to what it is. It's just music and, you know, connection and getting people together and having a good time. My dad has this great idea around songs and songwriting, and he's a musician as well. And we were kids, he said that, you know, the introduction to a song is like the back cover of a book. And if you can explain that to an audience, let them understand what they're about to listen to, their concept of the total narrative will be better. There's two banjo players in my band, 2 4-string banjo players and a mandolin and a fiddle, and I play guitar and bass at the same time, and we use a whole bunch of other things with our feet to make all the percussive sounds. And so it's strange. It's really strange for people at first, but people can really latch on and kind of understand, because that's part of our show. We pretty much tell you everything you need to know about us at the show.
Enjoying a conversation with David Howley. He is lead singer, guitar player, as he just mentioned, We Banjo 3, about to begin a tour. They're going to Milwaukee. They're going to Oshkosh. Everybody loves to say Oshkosh. Madison, Eau Claire, Green Bay, and Viroqua. You know that phrase, the best of both worlds. You guys have the best of 3 worlds. You are related pairs of brothers, so you have the same musical blood running through you guys. You have a knack for mixing vocals very nicely. The third leg is you have a whale of a time instrumentally.
That was the whole motive behind starting the band. Nobody ever started a band to make money. They should make a book, Musicians 101, first page. If you're in this to make money, stop. There are easier ways to make a living. So our first impetus when we started the band was, we just want to have fun. We're lucky, I think, in that way as well, is that we sing and we do harmonies. But I think one of the cool things is we do instrumentals. And what I've found is that, you know, a lot of young people love like dance music. Just seems to be beats and a little bit of melody. And you know, you see it, you're driving your car and someone pulls up next to you and you can feel the bass from their car in your teeth. Well, we kind of attribute the instrumentals for us are kind of like that, done in a folk style, because there's no lyrics, but there's music, and there's a lot of music that you can follow, and it's a little bit more subtle. And so those instrumentals are so fun for us to play on stage, because we pretty much make them up as we go along. We change them. We don't always take the same roadmap, but man, it makes the show so fun for us.
You have a kinship with this state, your first American gig.
Yeah, our first American gig was back in 2012. We played Milwaukee Irish Festival. It's actually where we figured out that there was something special about the band. The ethos is always to have fun, have a good time, make people smile, and that's it. And we did Milwaukee Irish Festival the first time. We played maybe 4 or 5 gigs over the weekend. And our first gig was in this tiny little tent, and there was maybe 20 people there. And I'm pretty sure most of those people were lost. But by the end of the weekend, in that same tent, again, there was probably about 1,500 to 2,000 people trying to cram into this tiny tent, because we were just having fun. And I think people latched onto it. And I think we can kind of look back now and say that the career of the band would not have been the same if we hadn't played Milwaukee Irish Festival for the first time. It's where we learned so much about ourselves as a band and so much about our music. Again, it just spurred us on in that direction to go out and just have fun. And we've just done it ever since. Being from Ireland and growing up there, coming to America and feeling that amount of love for Irish people and Irish culture, it really does mean a huge deal to us. So we feel that in Wisconsin. Crowds are great. People are willing to come out and just have fun. That's why we're doing our world tour of Wisconsin.
Attaboy. David Holly on the phone. We Banjo 3 is the group. They're traveling around Wisconsin. And the other day, I spoke with the gentleman who's responsible for bringing you to the Eau Claire venue, the Metro. This gentleman admits that he is attempting to jumpstart an Irish festival, and I cannot think of better ambassadors than you guys to help him do that.
There's something special in Wisconsin around Irish music, and I genuinely think it's just the cultures are very, very similar. Apart from you have a lot more cheese than we do. But apart from that, we're pretty similar. Like, good music, good beer.
What do people enjoy in Ireland with beer?
Generally, and actually I remember this from being a kid. When I was 11, me and Martin had a regular Friday night gig in a local bar. It was really interesting to kind of grow up in that scene and grow up with the responsibility of playing music as well. I mean, that's how I funded my college, and all that was through music. And one of the things normal in Ireland is that, you know, at about 1 a.m., randomly, just trays of sandwiches and little tiny cocktail sausages will just appear around the bar. That's the truest form of an Irish bar ever, is that when they don't serve a single other item of food, the only way you can get food is if you're there at the right time, randomly you'll be handed a tray of sandwiches. That's the real deal right there. So if we can get Wisconsin on board with that, at about 1 o'clock, no matter what bar or nightclub you're in, you just get handed around a tray of sandwiches. That would be the best.
Guinness. I don't think I've ever thanked a true Irishman for Guinness. So, David, thank you.
You know what? You're more than welcome. They used to give Guinness to women after they give birth.
Really?
It used to be a thing. Yeah, yeah. It's very high in iron. Guinness is the new Gatorade. The Green Bay Packers, they should let their sponsorship go with Gatorade or whoever they're with and just go straight with Guinness. That's the magic stuff there.
One final note. Tell me about the association with Mental Health America and how your latest album, Haven, which we are going to feature segments of, is linked to it.
The link with Mental Health America kind of came up very organically over the last couple of years. One of the songs on the new album is called Don't Let Me Down, which we brought out a music video for recently. And the song is based around mental health, mental ill health, I suppose. It's a problem all over the world. I suffered with mental ill health and still do from time to time. But I was very lucky that I was, you know, in a good band, and I had a brother, and I kind of inherited two other brothers, and I was in a very solid place, and I had a lot of support. And not everybody gets that chance. So we kind of wanted to make sure that we could kind of continue that conversation through the kind of positivity of our music. We wanted to do something that was more long lasting, and we started a partnership. So $2 off every t-shirt we sell on this tour goes towards Mental Health America. We kind of speak about a bit in the show. The main aim is to just bring people together. And I think community is often the cure to a lot of mental health problems and a lot of issues is just being around people and just feeling supported. And we're very, very lucky Mental Health America allowed us to use their online anonymous mental health screening tools. So if people want to use them, if they go to WeBanjo3, the number 3.com, there's a tab there that they can take a free online anonymous assessment. It just gives you some information and maybe a few links and some reading material. We just wanted to play our little part in it, so we're delighted to be in partnership with them.
Why doesn't it surprise me that in addition to making marvelous music and having a great time doing it, you guys also have character and boatloads of responsibility? Good for you guys. David Howley, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Lay down your weapons and lay down with me. We will stare at the stars and think what life could be. Islander memories, we'll leave them where they lie. Could we make a choice for love and joy? The moon lights a path we can travel down. River runs wild with what has gone before. Cast aside for new and more and more and more and more and more and more. Let me be your haven.
That's the title tune from their new album. It's called Haven. That's We, Banjo 3, next Wednesday evening, March 6th. The Metro, downtown Eau Claire. If you like real good musicians and a show that'll take your mind off of what's going on outside, you will be there. The Metro Facebook page has some We Banjo 3 video, and the band website again is WeBanjo3, that's the number 3.com. Oh, that's fun stuff. Couple of Spectrum memos for you. The Women in Culinary Fundraiser is coming up Friday at 5:30 to 8:30 at Forge in Banbury Place. There's a new scholarship at CVTC entitled Women in Culinary to support a female enrolled in the culinary management program. So take that in. Saturday, the Wide Spot in Stockholm welcomes back Four Pints Shy, the Irish band from Minnesota. 7 p.m. Widespot.org. Don't forget, this is the weekend of performances for Traffic. Memorial High School putting on the play, Riverside Theater, Haas Fine Arts Center, UW Eau Claire. Thanks to Kate for archiving, Erica for releasing, and Dean for superintending. Coming up next week, Scandinavian musicians return to Luck, Wisconsin, and WPR, the second series of programs to honor a 150th birthday, and more. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. Thank you. See you next week.
You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller is next. And stay with us at 12:30 for Chapter a Day, as Jim Fleming and Susan Sweeney read from the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows.